Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Now the election's over, we're working out our program for next year, but that'll be up soon, and probably in the next couple of weeks we'll finalise that. It's great to have Michael Ledeen back at the Institute. This is the third occasion on which Michael Ledeen has spoken to us. Last time in the State Library on his book, The War Against the Terror Masters, and today on his most recent book, which is not available in Australia yet, but has recently been released in the United States. I'll be very brief. Michael Ledeen is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. He's the author of around 24 books, mainly non-fiction, some fiction, and Michael tells me that he's not sure sometimes about the divisions, but we know. And I should also say thanks to Colin Rubenstein and the Australia-Israel and Jewish Affairs Council, who brought Michael Ledeen to Australia and made it possible for him to address the Sydney Institute tonight. So, on the occasion of the release of his most recent book, The Iranian Time Bomb, Michael Ledeen's going to talk to us about the Iranian time bomb. Thank you, Michael. I wouldn't.
Well, Sure, how long do you want me to talk?
I think about an
hour and a half.
Let's do the short version of 30 minutes. And question time, no longer than a couple of hours. So let's do questions. Talk about 30 minutes, question about 30 minutes, finish no later than 7. Okay?
Okay. I often think that it's better to do questions first, then to talk, then more questions. So please feel free to interrupt if you want to interrupt.
I wouldn't recommend it. I'll run this. If you give them a license, I'll take it. Don't. Give a talk, we'll take questions, I'll run it.
I mean, it's one of the reasons why people love to come to Australia, you know. Rough and tumble, lots of fun.
Wide
open. Okay, I'll talk about Iran for about half an hour, and then see what's on your minds. Iran is, if you're worried about terrorism, and who isn't, Iran really is the center of the universe, because Iran is the biggest and baddest sponsor of terrorism in the world, and has been for a very long time. The United States Department of State every year or two comes out with a list of state sponsors of terrorism. Iran always wins the competition. They're always in the number one position. They have created some of the most efficient and lethal terrorist organizations in the world, starting with Hezbollah, which is arguably the greatest killer in the world, even counting Al-Qaeda. They created Islamic Jihad. They supported Al-Qaeda, at least since the mid-1990s, and there's some question as to what happened before then. So when it comes to killing people, the Iranians really have no peer. They have been the biggest sponsor of terrorism around the world, and their organizations are global, Hezbollah having killed from Beirut to Saudi Arabia to Buenos Aires and so forth. And before 9/11, they had killed more Americans than any other terrorist organization. It is also, if you believe, as I believe, that one of the most important ways to evaluate the behavior of a country in the world is to look at the way they treat their own people. Iran is one of the nastiest countries in the world. The oppression of the Iranian people is right up there with the best of the misogynistic Middle Eastern regimes, women are evaluated officially as worth half of a man, to the point where if a woman pregnant with a male child gets killed in an automobile accident and an Islamic court judges the other driver to have been at fault, he has to pay one full fine to the family of the victims for the male fetus and half a share to the family for the woman. So the woman is officially, technically, legally, specifically worth half of a man. Women have no property rights. Women can't make any basic decisions about their lives without permission of a male relative. And as everybody knows by now, women can't walk down the street hand in hand with a man not a relative of hers, nor technically is she supposed to walk down the street alone without some relative, male relative accompanying her, although that one is not really enforced as strictly as some of the other regulations. So it's a very nasty society. And as you undoubtedly know, women are compelled to cover their heads. Few people know the reason for that, by the way. Head covering is not part of Sharia law. It's not an official requirement of Islam. The reason for covering the hair is because Iranian Shiite clerics have found that women's hair emit very dangerous sexual radiations, and that if their hair is not covered out, these radiations, these emissions, are likely to corrupt otherwise virtuous and respectable men and drive them to do all kinds of dreadful things. And so it is to protect the men, not from their own impulses, but from the corrupting force that would otherwise come from women's hair, that they're required to cover it up. And so the question of how much to cover and how much hair is exposed becomes a very important one. And so morals police tread the streets looking at women, and to make sure that only a very, if any, hair is showing it at all, it's a very small amount, so that public virtue can be maintained. It is a society in which women who commit adultery are stoned to death, and where executions, and Iran is the number two country in the world in terms of executions on a per capita annual basis. Executions are frequently public, often spectacular. Hangings carried out by cranes that drop down. The person is hung and then lifted up into the air and remains there as a kind of public demonstration of what happens to people who go against the strictures of the regime. The prison system is extensive. Nobody knows the real numbers for it. All we know is that every year or two they find that they don't have enough prison space, even though they do kill a lot of people in their prisons. And consequently, repression goes on apace. Anyone who sticks his or her head out of a trench and criticizes the regime is rounded up, put in prison, tortured, beaten. And the Iranians have developed a technique of torture, which to me anyway is one of the most awful. That is, they will take a person, put him or her in prison, torture them, and reduce them to a terrible condition, and then release them briefly on furlough back to their families, so that all their friends, relatives, and neighbors can see exactly what happens to a person who challenges the regime. So they become a living or half-dying example of what would happen to you if you chose to challenge this regime. And then those people are rounded up and put back into prison and subjected to more torture for the duration of their term. There is no appeal of judgment from an Islamic court. That was one of the prime ingredients of Khomeini's revolution in 1979. He was enraged at the very idea that a criminal who was sentenced to some kind of punishment could appeal to some other court and other judges could express opinions about these things. And so he said, henceforth, there will no longer be civil courts in Iran, but only Islamic courts, and there's no appeal from an Islamic court, so justice will be swift and final. And in the early days of the revolution, it was even worse than it is now, because they had really crazy people running the courts, of whom the most famous was Ayatollah Khalkhali, who was known as the cat killer because his habit was to kill cats whenever he had the chance. And he just sentenced hundreds of people to death, seemingly randomly, because it's hard to figure out why a lot of them had that happen to them. People who go to Iran, who try to find out the details of this kind of regime, they themselves are subjected to enormous danger. There's the famous story of a Canadian female Iranian-Canadian journalist named Zahra Kazemi, who went to Iran a few years ago, started to examine what had happened to some of the leaders of the student movement, which had protested against the excesses of the regime. She was arrested, tortured, and killed in prison, and her family, thus far at least, has been unable even to be permitted to dig up the body and bring it back to Canada for burial in her adopted country. So it's a very nasty place. And again, as Sharansky has said, if you agree, as I agree, that if you want to understand how a country's going to be, how a country will behave internationally, look at the way they treat their own people, because they're going to treat the rest of the world with the same attitudes that they bring towards their own people. It gives you some notion of what Iran is up to. And the Iranian regime is driven by what one can only call a really crazy messianic vision of the times in which we live and what is about to happen. It is a radical messianic Shiite regime. Do you know, by the way, I mean, it's often said, a lot is made about differences between Sunnis and Shiites. How many of you here know the difference between a Sunni and a Shiite? Well, that's good. We've got two, or one and a half. Make it three. Yeah, you think?
Just shy.
All right. Well, I don't want to embarrass you by asking you to spell it out, but basically the disagreement is over a line of succession to the Prophet Muhammad, and there was a disagreement somewhere along the line about who was the legitimate successor, and the Sunnis picked one and the Shiites picked the other, and this is the basis for a dispute which over the centuries has evolved into a significant theological slash political difference, which is that Sunnis were the vast majority of Islam, believe that civil society can be governed by either a secular person or a cleric, whereas the Shiites traditionally believe that no cleric should really be involved in civil government until the Messiah comes, until the 12th Imam returns, the 12th Imam being a 9 or 10 year old boy who was in the line of succession to Muhammad, who vanished about 1300 years ago, and they believe to have lived in the bottom of a well in Iran ever since then. And at the time of final judgment, he will reemerge into the real world and lead the final glorious jihad of Islam against the infidels and crusaders, which is to say us, those of us who do not believe. And the current government of Iran has gone even farther. Not only do they publicly express their fealty to the 12th Imam and their belief in his imminent return, but they have signed a contract with him. And so Ahmadinejad and his cabinet filled out a formal contract to agree to do certain things to encourage the return of the 12th Imam. And this was signed by every member of the cabinet and then dropped down this well so that the 12th Imam himself should know that at long last he had a government which was loyal to him and was going to carry out his strictures and so forth. For our purposes, what's, unless you know you find this attractive and want to convert to it, for political purposes, what's important about this is that the return of the 12th Imam is supposed to take place against the background of a time of troubles, global chaos, enormous wars and bloodshed and so forth. It is in that, as Islam so often is, similar to the visions of the final days that one finds in Christianity and in other apocalyptic visions and so forth. What's unique is that most Christian nations have given this up as a central element of their foreign policy, whereas the Iranians believe that everything they can do to make the world bloodier and more violent and more chaotic and more dangerous will encourage the return of the 12th Imam. So that, my background is in cultural history. I spent 15 years, first 15 years of my professional career in fascist archives. And it's surprising to me. I mean, it's really striking about the various things that this revolutionary regime in Iran has in common with fascism, certainly in its first generation or generation and a half. Like fascism, the Iranian regime is a regime of mass mobilization. It's not a kind of didactic, oppressive kind of regime as communist regimes typically are. It's one that tries always to gather the people in and get them to participate in big public spectacles and march in the streets and dance and sing and chant and so forth. So there are big public events. Iran is a big country, 70 million people, big public squares, long tradition of public ceremony and so forth. And in that they are similar. It is as the fascist states were a single-party dictatorship. Only the faithful are permitted to participate. There is no tolerance whatsoever for people who wish to challenge it. With rare exceptions, maybe two or three people, grand ayatollahs who at one point were personally associated with Khomeini in the run-up to the revolution, who since 1979 have challenged some of the bases on which this regime rests. And they are, by and large, under house arrest. People like Ayatollah Montazeri and so forth, who was Khomeini's closest associate in the run-up to the revolution. And but these aside from them, people of such stature that not even that regime feels free to go after them. All the others are under near total repression. Anything approaching a free press was stamped out in the last 10 or 15 years. People who go online on the internet are immediately suspect. People who travel abroad now are all labeled as potential traitors and are therefore interrogated and investigated and so forth as soon as they get back to the country. It's a very unpleasant place. And it is a regime which, given its messianic predilections, believes that it is destined to lead a global revolution and therefore to rule the world. And hardly a week goes by without some senior figure in this regime, whether it's Ahmadinejad, who gets all the headlines recently, or a person who's rarely named but is the one really important man in Iran, Ali Khamenei, whose job title is Supreme Leader, which tells you something about how that system works. Hardly a week goes by without one of them standing up and lecturing large numbers of Iranians and telling them that they must prepare themselves to rule the world. So it's not a movement, it's not a regime that one should take lightly. They believe these things. And one of my favorite jokes for folks of this nature, because I have enormous respect for the talents of Iranians, who, after all, are one of the oldest civilizations on the face of the earth. I mean, Persia. You can well argue that Persia was the first real modern civilization. It goes back a good 4,000 years. Anyway, this favorite joke of mine is a man's driving down the street, has a flat tire opposite, right in front of an insane asylum. And so he gets out of his car and he jacks it up and he takes off the flat. And he removes the lugs and he puts them very carefully into the hubcap and pushes it over to the side of the road and goes to the trunk to take out the spare. And some lunatic on a motorcycle comes by and clips the hubcap. The lugs fly into the air and go right down the drain. And he stands there looking at it, feeling helpless, and hears a voice from the other side of the fence. And the voice says, "It's not so bad. You don't need four lugs to hold on a wheel. Three are more than enough. You have three other wheels. Each wheel has four lugs on it. Take one lug off of each of the other three. Attach the wheel. In the fullness of time, buy yourself four new lugs. Put one on each of the wheels. And, you know, you'll be fine." So the guy realizes that his friend on the other side of the fence is right. So he does that. And as he's jacking the car down, he looks across and the fellow's still there. And he said, "Could I ask you a personal question?" The guy says, "Sure." He says, "You've lived there?" He says, "Yeah." He said, "So how were you able to solve this problem so quickly?" The guy looks at him and he says, "Look, I may be crazy, but I'm not stupid." These are the Iranians. Right? The people in this regime are crazy, but they're very smart and they're very talented. And it's in many ways a terrific culture. You know, great food, great art, good scientists, good military, lots of things that one can learn from the Iranians. Unfortunately, they have fallen into the hands of this extremely nasty regime. And this regime really wants to do us in. And for the last nearly 29 years, February will mark the 29th anniversary of the Iranian Revolution of 1979, they have waged war against the Western world. They declared war in February of 1979. Khomeini openly said that their intention was to destroy the West and to export this revolution everywhere and to subject the entire world to this kind of rule and this sort of society. And they have waged this war against us nonstop ever since. Now, the odd thing about this is not that they should do it. I mean, after all, they believe it, and they've said it, and they have the capacity to do it, and so they have set out to destroy us, just as they promised. What is striking about this case is the non-reaction of the entire Western world, because in all these 29 years, nobody, not the United States, not Western Europe, not anybody, has really gone after this regime, which you would think is relatively obvious. Not even celebrated warmongers like George W. Bush or Ronald Reagan. It really hasn't mattered. Every president, every American president, from Jimmy Carter to the present, Democrat or Republican, left-wing or right-wing, celebrated hawk, celebrated dove, they have all done exactly the same thing, which is they have convinced themselves that somehow or other it is possible to make a grand bargain with the Iranian regime, find a modus vivendi, and move on. And it's true of all of them. This administration, which throughout the world is thought of as some kind of insane, hawkish country administration, which lives only to invade again and kill again, they have been negotiating with the Iranians virtually nonstop since the beginning of this administration, as every other American administration did. I mean, negotiations with Iran, which are frequently invoked as a kind of criticism of the Bush administration, negotiations with Iran have been going on all these years, all the time. They're going on today. I mean, just last September, the Condoleezza Rice sent Felipe Gonzalez, the former socialist prime minister of Spain, a serious person, a very smart person, sent him to Tehran to talk to Larijani, everybody's favorite Iranian negotiator, to see if there wasn't some way we could work out at least some of our differences and reach some kind of cooperative relationship. And Felipe had come back and said, there's no hope. And interestingly enough, about 7 years earlier, the Clinton administration had sent the same Felipe Gonzalez to Tehran to talk to the Iranians to see if there wasn't some way that we could work out our disagreements and have some kind of workable relationship short of violence. And he came back then and said exactly the same thing. No hope. They're not interested. And here again, you know, I think I'm from Los Angeles originally. I'm a Hollywood kid, I think, in terms of movies. And this situation seems to me to have been best described in the wonderful James Bond movie Goldfinger. You may remember the scene in the middle of the movie where Bond is spread-eagled out on the sheet of gold, and there's a laser beam slicing through the sheet of gold headed for his private parts. And at a certain point, he looks up and he says to Goldfinger, "Do you expect me to talk?" And Goldfinger looks down at him and he says, "No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die." And that's the Iranians. They're not interested in talking. I mean, if you want to talk, they'll talk. But basically, what they're interested in is they want us to die. They want to kill us or destroy us or dominate us or something. And that is the pattern of the behavior all along. Now, of course, nowadays, what everybody thinks of when you talk about Iran is the bomb. Because Iran famously has a nuclear project, which sensible people recognize to be a nuclear weapons project. And in fact, we know exactly when they went on a real hard drive to get nuclear weapons. And it was after the first Gulf War of 1991, when they saw what happened to Saddam. And they said, well, you see, if Saddam had only had nuclear weapons, the Americans would never have attacked him in Kuwait, and he would have kept it. Therefore, we must have nuclear weapons. So whatever it is we want to do in the future, the Americans won't dare come after us, and we will be invulnerable to them. And so ever since, they've been racing weights to develop a nuclear weapon. You may ask yourself, if these very smart people, and they are very smart people, and for extras, very wealthy people, because you may have noticed the price of oil has been going up for some time, they're drowning in money. How is it that in 16 years they've been unable to develop an atomic bomb? Or so it seems, because all the experts say to us they're 5 to 10 years away from nuclear weapons. Occasionally somebody disagrees and says, no, it's 2 to 3. But if you just think, the United States, back in the 1940s, went from zero to atomic bomb in 4 years, at a time when nobody even knew whether an atomic bomb would work. It had never been done before. 4 years. How can the Iranians in 16 years, in a world where nuclear technology is all over the place, where nuclear physicists are for sale, where people like AQ Khan from Pakistan are out there in the nuclear bomb market selling things to everybody, to the Iranians, to the Libyans, to the Syrians, to the Iraqis, and so forth, how can it be that they don't have such a thing? I mean, any sensible person, it seems to me, I don't have any information that differs from what the experts say about it, but it just seems to me common sense would grab you by the throat and say, well, most likely they have something. Something they must have. What I think they don't have is a combination of a nuclear bomb and a delivery system for it in which they have any real confidence that they can hit whatever it is they decide to target. Now, they also, many Iranian leaders have said Israel must be removed from the face of the earth, and as soon as we get an atomic bomb, we're going to drop it on Israel. And even if the Israelis respond and kill us all, it's a good deal for Islam, because we will have wiped out half the Jews in the world, and they will have left us with 1.1 billion Muslims, even if they kill every breathing Iranian today. Well, I mean, people who talk like this, if you take the history of the 20th century seriously, people who talk like this are very likely to act like that, especially a regime that really acts the way it talked in every area of life, above all in the treatment of their own people. So it would seem obvious that the Western world has a great interest in removing this regime, in changing the regime, especially when you know that the Iranian people overwhelmingly hate this regime and want to be rid of it. Right? Now, the best way to remove regimes of this sort is not by dropping bombs on them and not by invading them, not by military conquest, but by doing for the Iranian people the same thing that we did for the Poles, the Czechs, the Russians, and so forth, which is to say to encourage those people within that system who want to be free to become free and to provide them with the basic wherewithal they need to carry out a successful, nonviolent, democratic revolution. I'm one of those people who served in the Reagan administration in the 1980s. People asked us, you know, what were we about? Why would somebody like me, a lifelong Democrat, go into a Republican administration? And so forth. And the answer we always gave was, it's time to really go after the Soviet Empire and bring it down. And they thought we were all nuts, because they didn't believe there was any way to bring down the Soviet Empire short of global thermonuclear war, as the expression of the time went. Well, I don't think we were all that good, to tell you the truth. I mean, we were constantly frustrated at our inability to do many of the things that we wanted to do and so forth. Basically, what we did was to have a president who said, time has run out on this regime, and we don't want it anymore. The world will be a better place without it. And then broadcast to them, above all, the kind of information that people living under a repressive system need in order to organize themselves against their regime, but don't get. Because it turns out that what these regimes are best at blocking from the people is information about their own country. I mean, the Russians, the Czechs, the Poles, and so forth, the one thing they all listen to, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Voice of America, Deutsche Welle, BBC, and all of that stuff. And basically what they heard on those broadcasts were, until we got going on it, were things about London, Paris, Washington, Rome, and so forth. Not people in Moscow had a hard time getting accurate, up-to-date information about what was going on in Leningrad, let alone Siberia. So we undertook through the radios to tell them what was going on all over the country. Situation is much the same in Iran today. The people in Isfahan do not know quickly what is going on in Tehran. People in Tehran don't know about Shiraz and Tabriz. That information is much more difficult for them to get than, you know, what did the New York Times say today? Or what is CBS News broadcasting? Or what is the Democratic Party or President Bush saying about things in general? That they know about. What they don't know about is events all over their own country. So we need to broadcast that information to them. We have to get them up to speed to make sure they're informed. Plus, they need the tools of modern revolution, which are communications instruments. They need laptops, servers, software to be jamming systems and internet filters just of the same sort that one tries to get to the Chinese people who are in a similar circumstance. They need cell phones and satellite phones and phone cards and all these things so that they can communicate. I mean, we're lucky to have here Richard Fernandez, who's the editor, the Australian editor of a wonderful blog to which I contribute called Pajamas Media. And Pajamas Media is set up exactly for this kind of purpose, because all over the world, whenever something happens, there's not always a correspondent from some major network or some major publication, but there's always some guy with a digital camera and internet access. And so people with digital cameras can take pictures or videos of what is going on and upload it and send it all over the world, and it's important that as things like that happen, people in countries like Iran, and there are many others, have access to it, get to it, learn from it, see about it, see what's going on. And then finally, we should do the same thing for Iranian workers as we did for Solidarity and workers under the Soviet system, which is build them a strike fund. That is, they need to be able, in order to advance their own rights, workers need to be able to strike to withhold from their employers the one thing that their employers depend on, namely their own labor. And without a strike fund, if they walk off the job, their family is likely to starve to death, given current economic conditions in Iran. They need to be able to know, if they decide to go on strike, that they'll have enough money to support their family for a week or two or a month or two, whatever it is. Khomeini, interestingly enough, understood that. And in the year or two leading up to the revolution of 1979, he and his people smuggled great quantities, not of money, but food into Iran, big bags of rice, so that workers in Iran could go on strike and they would have rice in their homes to be able to survive. Well, that is the basic picture. I'm sure you've heard an awful lot, because the fanciful press is full of stories all the time about how the United States is getting ready to bomb Iran or invade Iran or strike at Iran across the border and so forth. So far as I know, I'm not in the government and I don't have any special access to people in the government, but so far as I know or can detect or smell or sense, there is no such intention. And I've been saying that for the last couple of years, at a time when all kinds of famous journalists have been writing it's only a matter of hours or minutes until the bombing starts. And I have said repeatedly, it's not going to happen. This administration is not going to do that. They do not feel any sense of urgency. They have been told by their intelligence community that Iran is years away from a bomb. And if they believe that Iran is years away from a bomb, then there's plenty of time to try all these other things, negotiations, sanctions, you name it, and so forth. So I don't think it's going to happen. And despite all the rhetoric from this administration about spreading democracy and spreading freedom, I think at this point that they don't see a good way to do in Iran. They do not believe, as I do, that the Iranian people want to carry out a revolution. And if they were given a bit of support, could probably do it. And so don't look for that. Don't hold your breath waiting for an outbreak of a new war in the Middle East aimed against Iran. It's not going to happen. So with that, I'll stop.
Thank you, Mark.
See if there are any questions.
Uh,
Many thanks. I should have mentioned earlier that the Uranium Time Bomb is published by St. Martin's Press in the US.
You can get it on Amazon.
And Amazon.com. And thanks to CAUSE for the use of this facility tonight. So we come to questions and discussion. I should tell you something personal. I mean, I stayed under the bed on Friday because we have our prophets here as well, false prophets, and one of our well-known commentators, Bob Ellis, predicted that George Bush would bomb Iran by Friday in order to save John Howard. Well, he did, actually. And I took it pretty seriously and didn't take a chance on Friday. But apart from another foul prophecy, I mean, would it be possible to bomb Iran? How would you bomb a nuclear facility in Iran? I mean, would it be... Is it a facility you could actually bomb?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what we think we know about it. But, I mean, judging from what people write about it and claim to know, it's decentralized, it's dispersed all over the country. Some of it is inside mountains, underneath cities, and so forth. I mean, at least one big facility, I think I know, is in a place called Parchin, which is an industrial park that was started by the Shah. In a suburb of Tehran, and there it is said that there is a virtual underground city of laboratories heavily armed with reinforced concrete and so forth. I don't know if it's true, but it is widely said. So if that is the case, then it's going to be very difficult to attack, very difficult to bomb. And in any case, bombing is the wrong thing to do regardless. I mean, it just makes no sense to bomb, in my opinion.
Okay, folks, there's plenty of time now. We've got till 7 o'clock, so don't get me in an agitated state. We're going to Richard Bronowski. Go down the back. Okay, and you can do some of this for us.
I'll try not to agitate you, Jared. And I say at the beginning that Arak and Natanz, south of Tehran, are the two main areas where they have nuclear enrichment capabilities. And they could be bombed with pinpoint accuracy. They have to use nukes. My worry is not so much the United States as Israel. The Israelis might believe the propaganda that you've been telling us about today. And can I say, I spent 2 years in Iran under the Shah, initially, that Sabak was just as bad as what I see is happening now. And you haven't mentioned moderates like Rafsanjani and Khatami and other people who tried very hard to have negotiations with the West. May I say to you that I don't believe that they're stupid or crazy. And I do believe that the Iranians, if and when they get the bomb, are not likely to use it. They have it for deterrence. And they built that as a deterrent when Iraqis were using poison gas against them during the 8-year war.
Now,
so,
Richard, having
said that, can I say, do you really think that Ahmadinejad and his colleagues, you painted them in a very black light, would be prepared to bomb Israel or threaten Israel, knowing that there would be instant obliteration? Do you really think they're prepared to do that? I don't.
Well, let me ask you a question in return.
Well, I wouldn't do that.
Oh, no.
Richard has spoken at the Institute on previous times, and he's in the habit. He wants to do it again. I think.
All right.
And we got other people.
So I won't ask.
No, don't ask. It encourages us.
All right. Well, anyway, the answer to the question is I think any sensible person, and certainly any prudent policymaker, must assume that they're telling the truth when they say these things. And I think that if I had any candidate running for office in my country who said, I don't believe a word of this, I think it's all for show or domestic consumption or whatever, I would never vote for that person because I don't want that kind of person making policy for me. It's just too dangerous. You must assume that they need it, just as a matter of simple prudence. The great moderate Rafsanjani, after all, is only wanted for murder in two foreign countries. A great moderate that is. And, you know, Khatami oversaw this monstrous slaughter of hundreds of thousands of Iranian intellectuals and students while he was president, and yet everybody went on proclaiming him to be a great reformer. So, you know, I've never been to Iran under the Shah or under these people. I do not claim to be the world's greatest expert on Iran. But the facts that I gave you this evening are almost universally agreed. And if you want to read a book by a person who is politically very different from me, but who really is a great expert on Iran. Read Ken Pollack's book, The Persian Puzzle, which contains a detailed discussion both of the history of modern Iran and of American negotiations with Iran and attempts by America to reach some kind of workable agreement with Iran. And in the end, he just throws his hands up in the air and says, we've tried everything. We've made every offer. We have threatened every consequence. And nothing works. It's not our fault. They don't want any kind of agreement with us. They do not want peace with us. They want war with us. That's what they've chosen. And I recognize that it's an unpleasant idea to swallow. I will only tell you that the people I know who are the greatest experts on Iran, who are fluent in the language, who have spent years there, who have dealt with the Iranian regime and all of that, they have all very reluctantly and unhappily come to this conclusion. And I'm certainly not going to defend Savak. But to compare Savak with this regime, I think, is really quite a stretch. I think that's overdoing it.
Okay, there's a question up there and then over here. Yeah. But we've got to keep the questions a bit shorter, otherwise. Okay.
My question echoes the earlier one. What role do you see Israel playing in dealing with the problem that you've outlined, and with what consequences?
Well, Israel's traditional approach to Iran has always started with the belief that Iran was too big for Israel to deal with. That is, 70 million people is just too much for Israel to tackle. I mean, it's hard enough for them to deal with Jordan, Iraq, Syria, you know, their traditional local enemies. And so when it comes to Iran policy, the Israeli approach has traditionally been to try to convince the United States to adopt the sort of policy that Israel thinks is appropriate. And so, until very recently, as far as I can tell, I must say I don't do Israel, I don't follow Israel very closely, so I'm not positive about that, but it seems to me that until quite recently, that was always the position they took, until they reached a point where they said to themselves, well, what if the Americans don't do anything? And what if we believe one morning that the Iranians are within, pick whatever your red line time period is, a year, 6 months, a month, an hour, whatever it is, they're about to have an operational nuclear weapon with a delivery system that can hit us. Then what? Then what do we do? And then you have to ask yourself, you know, the basic questions about how does government behave in a democratic society when they believe the survival of the country is threatened? What do they do? I don't know. I mean, they have a series of terrible options at that point. Look, I mean, when a Sarkozy stands up and says, French president stands up and says, we must do everything possible to avoid arriving at the day when we are forced to choose between Iran with the bomb or bombing Iran. Right? That's what I've been saying for years. You don't want to get to that day. You don't want that day. But in order to avoid arriving at that day, you've got to do something serious in the meantime. What is there? Sanctions are not going to do it. There's not a single case I know of where sanctions have effectively caused an enemy country to change its policy. I mean, the cases where sanctions seem to have worked are Chile and South Africa, and those were people who felt that sanctions were a stigma on them. They wanted to be in the Western world. And the fact that we delivered sanctions on them was offensive to them and caused them pain, political pain. Iran's not like that. Iran could care less about how we feel about them. They hate us. So, I mean, they're not going to change their policy about us simply because of sanctions. Anyway, you know, if sanctions work, terrific. I'd love to be wrong about this, but I don't know of a case where it's happened. So why not support revolution? I mean, my view is that the nuclear question is really secondary to the fact that Iranians have been killing us all these years. I think that we should have responded. I think we're morally obliged. And I think, and I agree with Kushner, who said that democratic countries have an obligation to support freedom fighters inside tyrannical regimes. I believe that. I think that's why we're here. I think we should be supporting democratic revolution in all these various countries. I think that if we don't stand for that, what do we stand for? And then you fold in on top of that the notion that if we don't do something, we're going to arrive at that day. We're going to be faced with that decision. And on that day, there are no good decisions left. Revolution may fail. It may not work. It may not work fast enough. Nobody knows. But it's the right thing to do, and if it does succeed, it's certainly the best solution. So why not try it? But nobody's willing to try it.
There's a question there, Rafi, and then down the back. Yeah.
Have there any...
No, hang on. Rafi. Okay. Yeah.
Another nuclear question, I'm afraid. If there were a bombing campaign from either Israel or America, what do you think the reaction of the Western-influenced moderate Arab states such as Jordan or Turkey would be?
I have no idea. I mean, my guess would be that it would depend on whether it succeeded and what the consequences inside Iran were. But you know, how they would react, who knows?
You mentioned this one effective way of challenging and removing this regime is by use of media, providing telecommunications equipment to dissidents in the country, and creating a strike fund. Civil action. It strikes me as those measures are not measures that a government needs to take. And my question is there an effective NGO doing just this? And if not, what do we do to create one?
I entirely agree with you that those actions are not actions that depend on a government. And I wish there were NGOs. I wish, for example, that the International Free Trade Union Organization were raising strike funds for Iranian workers and were publicly supporting them. I mean, the head of the transport workers union in Tehran, a man named Osanlu, one of the bravest people alive, who has survived several years of horrible torture inside Iranian jails, was released for a brief period, left the country, traveled around Western Europe, went to the various trade union associations and said, help us, support us, defend us, speak out for us, and then went back to Iran, knowing that he was going back to prison with all the horrible treatment that that entailed. And he's back in prison now. When's the last time you heard some Western trade union speak out for him? Right? Doesn't happen. The one ingredient that only a government can do, and probably only the American government can do, is to openly say we want regime change in Iran. Because Iranians believe that nothing of that magnitude can succeed without support of the United States.
Okay, there's a question down the back and then what's up here. Yeah.
I can't agree more with what you're suggesting, to encourage free-spirited, free-minded Iranians to get a different and alternative regime for Iran. But how can we actually achieve something like that when for years we are trying to be part of negotiations and we actually accuse Iranians for being evil, for torturing, for being terrorists in the end of the day? How can we actually convince those free-spirited, open-minded Iranians that they can rely on our support without keeping in mind that for all these years we're accusing them for being monsters?
Well, we haven't accused them of being monsters. We've been accusing the monsters who oppress them of being monsters. And if you use the Soviet metaphor for this, the Soviet precedent for it, it's exactly the same thing, isn't it? I mean, Ronald Reagan certainly spent a lot of nasty words about the Soviet regime, but he supported the Soviet people and he supported dissidents all over the Soviet Empire. So I'm just saying, do the same thing for the Iranians. Why are the Iranians unworthy of the same kind of assistance that we gave to Poles and Czechs and Hungarians and so forth? I really don't get it.
There's a question up at the front row. Okay, don't ask questions.
I didn't ask a question.
You said why?
It's rhetorical.
Oh. You talked before about the fact that the Iranians, the regime, can see you as being irrational, crazy, mad, etc., etc. And yet you're involved in the Reagan administration, which is directly negotiating with the Iranians in the Iran-Contra affair. So I'm curious to ask how that works. If you believe on one level they're nuts, and you believe directly negotiating with them and selling them arms.
Well, I didn't sell them arms. The government of the United States sold them arms. I was a courier, and I did participate in negotiations. And I would hope that since you're familiar with the fact that I dealt directly with the regime, that you would take much very seriously when I tell you that I think they're nuts. Because after all, I've dealt with them first person, one-on-one. So I know them firsthand. I've seen it.
There's a question here, Stuart. Yeah, thank you. Mr. Levine, in Commentary Magazine of October 2007, a colleague of yours from the American Enterprise Institute, Joshua Muravich.
Muravich.
Yeah, thank you. Said the following. He said, a more serious version of the wrong place argument came from within the neoconservative camp itself, and specifically from Michael Levine of the American Enterprise Institute. He argued in 2003 that we should focus not on Iraq, but on Iran. Taking that into account, your association with neoconservatism, in the October 22nd of 2007 Newsweek, it says that the neoconservatives have moved their support to Rudolph Giuliani in the presidential election. If that is the case, why is that the case, that the neoconservatives are supporting Rudolph Giuliani?
Well, I think there might be two questions.
Well, I don't know. I'm not aware. I mean, if I'm a neoconservative, I have not. I'm not supporting Giuliani or any other particular candidate. I'm not associated with the campaign and so forth. And the very fact that Josh, who is a neoconservative himself, should point out in his article and commentary that we don't agree, should give you some pause before you assume that all neoconservatives are singing from the same hymnal. You know, we disagree on all kinds of things. We certainly disagree about bombing Iran. He's in favor of bombing Iran, and I'm opposed to it. Norman Podhoretz, who's the editor of Commentary, wants to bomb Iran, famously wrote a whole book about it. And I wrote a whole book arguing that we shouldn't bomb Iran. I mean, there's plenty of disagreements. Free country, you know. People have all kinds of different ideas.
I think the last time you were at the Sydney Institute, you said that Iran was a much more serious problem than Iraq.
Well, I was right, wasn't I? I mean, my position before the invasion of Iraq was that the invasion of Iraq was a mistake. It was the wrong war in the wrong time in the wrong place, and that Iran was the base. If you were going to fight a war against terror, states that support terror, Iran was the major, and is, the major terror supporter. And therefore, we should go after Iraq, and that furthermore, it was wrong to launch a huge military invasion of the Middle East when you could do it politically, not militarily. Even in the case of Iraq, it was possible to do a lot more politically than we did. And I proposed various ways of doing that. So, I mean, I'm not, you know, I don't feel bound to defend the things that this administration did, even though it's a commonplace that neoconservatives, and therefore I, are somehow key to understanding the behavior of the Bush administration.
I think you just said then that we should go after Iraq. I think you meant to say we should go after Iran.
Iran first. Iran was the place to start. Now Iran remains the place.
Okay, we're not having any dumb questions. There's a question over here. I've got to move quickly. Yeah. It's got to be quick. And it can't be on Frank Sartor and Cameron.
No, no, no.
So there might be a point.
What's that about?
That's a local joke.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Of Europe. You've had a great strength within Europe. First of all, a lot of people were Roman Catholics, and a lot of people were supported by the Vatican, and you had an internal structure of people who weren't mad keen on atheistic communism, however it turned out. And, you know, have you got anything equivalent in Iran that would, you know, ferment it from below? And my father's a pastor.
Ah, good question. Well, in part, in part, the people of Iran have been sort of vaccinated against radical Islam. You always have to be careful not to talk about Islam in general, because it's not Islam in general. There are lots of terrific Muslims in this world. But this version of Islam that Khomeini preached and that the Islamic Republic of Iran is carrying out is particularly noxious and dangerous. And yeah, there's lots of Iranians. I mean, Iran, Tom Friedman has described Iran as the only red state in the Middle East, that is to say, the only pro-Bush country in the Middle East. And every September 11th, the people in the big cities in Iran show up in the evening with carrying lighted candles through the streets mourning what happened to America. And it's the only country in the world that I know of where this kind of thing happens. So yeah, there's plenty of, I'm morally convinced that if there were free elections in Iran, nobody with a turban would be elected to anything. And it would be a generation before such people would be elected to positions of high power. And one of the most common anecdotes in Iran these days is that if a cleric wants to get a taxi, he's got to take off his turban and his robe and hide it in his briefcase, because otherwise the taxi won't pick him up.
I'm extending the question that was just completed here. You mean to say there was so far no internal revolt against the regime, for instance, by students?
Oh, not at all. There's hardly a week goes by without large-scale demonstrations against the regime.
The question down the back of the
You make the good point that Iran will humour the US with talks, but it really wants war. Are there other countries who could have a meaningful discussion with Iran, if not immediately, over the medium term?
Well, it tempts me to give you my theory about Russia, but it's a bit too long. Well, the abbreviated version is that Russia Putin is very upset at this radical Islamic country right on his borders, supporting Chechens, supporting radical Muslims all over the stands and so forth. And so he's pushing the Iranians into conflict with the United States, hoping that the United States bombs it and destroys it and does his dirty work for him. And I mean, I have no proof of this except one small thing, which is that at a certain point, as he pushes them forward, which he certainly does, and says the Americans are paper tigers, don't worry about them, they're not going to do anything to you, and so forth. And even if they did, he must have said to them at one point, I will protect you, and in fact, I'm going to give you the world's greatest air defense system, which has in fact been installed around their major cities and the nuclear sites and so forth. And he sold the same system to Syria. But of course, if he wanted us to destroy them, the system wouldn't work. And in fact, it doesn't work, as was just demonstrated by the Israeli raid against Syria. And you can be damn sure that the Iranians look at that and say, aha, the Russians are tricking us again, because there's 500 years of that. And I did this in a radio broadcast on Radio Farda recently, and the guy asked me, well, what's your evidence for this theory? And I said, well, you know, this business about the air defense system. And I said, in any way, you can be quite sure that every living Iranian believes this. And that the guy doing the interview was an Iranian-American. I said, you believe it too, don't you? And he said, yes. And this interview went all over the Middle East because people believe it. Right? I don't know if it's true. I mean, I just thought it was a sort of fun theory, and, you know, I'm not in government, so if I'm wrong, so what? I'm wrong a lot. So I just thought it's a good way of thinking about it, because it's a good way to show you how complicated the world really is, because it's an absolutely plausible theory, absolutely plausible. And footnote, I never got a call from the Russian embassy in Washington and say, why are you saying these things? Right? And often when you write something that makes them upset, and that can't have pleased them, and they, you know, they think it's wrong, they call you up and say, I can't write this thing, such nonsense. I never got that call. So that's maybe the second element of evidence.
Just a final quick question. The Iranian time bomb, your book. What do you think there would be a difference
between a Republican administration in about a year's time and a Democrat administration on this issue, or do you think there's sort of a bipartisan approach in the United States?
Well, that takes us into Iraq and the effect that what's going on in Iraq has on the Iranian regime and so forth, and that's complicated. The Democrats have been saying that if they ever get their hands on power in the United States, they're going to pull all the troops out of Iraq. This at a moment when al-Qaeda has been destroyed in Iraq and that the casualty rates all over the country have dropped from 50 to 80%, and where, you know, for the first time in several years, living is approaching normal in most of the country. If the Democrats, in fact, did pull troops out of Iraq, that would be an enormous boost for the Iranian regime, because everybody in the region knows that the Iranians have been supporting al-Qaeda, and everybody knows that the defeat of al-Qaeda in Iraq is a real blow to the Iranian regime. And suddenly they would be able to turn around and say, you see, we won, we drove the Americans out. So that would have a big effect. Aside from that, I think that the next major policy decision on Iran will happen when some big event happens involving Iran. And what that will be, I can't tell you. Whether it's going to be a nuclear test or whether it's going to be some dramatic action in which we catch them doing some evil thing. At that point, I have to believe that the American people would demand action against Iran of some sort. And I don't think it would matter much at that point whether it was a Democratic president or a Republican president. As after 9/11, I don't think it would have mattered one bit as to whether it was a Republican or a Democrat. I think the government of the United States would have reacted in much the same way as Bush reacted after 9/11, because that's just the way the country is. That's us.
Many thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Jerry.
Well, firstly, thanks to Colin Rubinson and the Australian Israel and Jewish Affairs Council for making it possible to put Michael Levine on tonight. And thanks to Michael Levine for once again for a lively and stimulating talk. Well done, Michael.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.